Hello and welcome to Battlecast. I'm Dr. Luke Wolf, and today we're picking up exactly where we left off with the 1775 Battle of Bunker Hill. And I've got to say, it's an interesting battle, complete with seaborne invasions of an entrenched position and suicidal frontal charges straight down narrow, pre-cleared firing lanes. In other words, get ready for blood to flow out of your speakers. But before we get into that, I've got to thank Jim from Redding, California, and Bo and Wendy from Sandpoint, Idaho, for buying us around. I also have to thank Frank and all the guys and girls working night shift at Aberdeen Royal Infirmary in Aberdeen, Scotland. We love all you guys working night shift out there, and I just felt a calling to thank all the truckers around the world listening to this podcast tonight. Thank you for trucking. Thank you for delivering those goods. I've also got to thank Daryl and all the guys at Fuquay Guns. Daryl, they treated me so good out there. If you live near Fuquay Guns, go out there, give them some business. They treated me so well. Shooting the MP5 was a great joy. I've seen this gun in movies so many times, and to be able to actually fire one for free, I mean, they treated me like royalty. It was unbelievable. Thank you so much for the time you guys gave us. And thanks for listening, guys. So appreciate everybody at Fuquay Guns. Appreciate everybody that donates. Appreciate all of you guys. I'm so thankful for you listening. And if you don't like me, man, I'm thankful for you too. I wouldn't hurt you for the world. And I mean that. I'm not just saying it. Anyway, I'm thankful for all of you out there, and I appreciate you tuning in. God knows no one else gives a shit, right? But now, the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now, if you remember from last month's show, after the Battle of Lexington and Concord, the British retreated into the city of Boston, which I should point out is located on a peninsula. At the same time, the Americans spread out around the city, mostly on high ground, their numbers constantly augmented by the arrival of American militia from rural Massachusetts and nearby colonies. Victor Brooks describes the importance of Boston in 1775 with these words, quote, "The city of Boston in 1775 was the third largest community in the American colonies. With a population of 16,000 compared to New York's 25,000 and Philadelphia's 30,000. At the time of Lexington and Concord, Boston was a pear-shaped peninsula containing only 800 acres of primarily hilly land that was surrounded by water. The only connection to the mainland was a narrow marsh called Boston Neck, which flooded during heavy rainstorms and was swept by spray even in fair weather. The town was dominated by a number of hills. Most private dwellings were made of wood, which made the city extremely vulnerable to British threats to burn the town to the ground if the Patriots made a serious attempt to capture it. The most militarily significant feature of 18th century Boston was its massive series of wharves along the southern side of the town, which extended as far out as half a mile into the water and provided docking and repair facilities for dozens of ships at a time. The city was the largest shipbuilding center in the British Empire and possibly the world, as one-third of all British ships were constructed in the community. Yet another reason Britain wanted to keep America firmly in the empire. The strategic importance of the city was reflected in the firepower of Admiral Graves' American squadron, which carried a total of 350 guns and over 2,000 seamen. This impressive naval force, combined with General Gage's land-based forces and a large contingent of Royal Marines, meant that by the spring of 1775, there were actually more British military personnel stationed in Boston than adult male civilians living in the city. The siege of Boston was relatively unusual in the sense that most of the civilians in the town were in sympathy with the besieging army. Soon after the colonial troops surrounded the city, General Gage, who was obsessed with the possibility of a civilian uprising, began encouraging residents to leave town. Gage negotiated an informal agreement with the Massachusetts Committee of Safety, under which anyone could leave Boston with all his possessions that they could carry, providing that the evacuees turned in any weapons and agreed to refrain from joining the colonial army. In turn, all Loyalist sympathizers could cross Boston Neck with no interference from Patriot forces. A steady stream of civilians crossed Boston Neck into Roxbury afterwards, end quote. But I want to note right here that out of a population of roughly 4,000 adult males, the British confiscated 1,778 muskets, plus 643 pistols, along with 973 bayonets and 38 blunderbusses. You men of Massachusetts and New England, that's what your forefathers thought about the right to keep and bear arms. They had guns falling off the damn walls. Our colonial forefathers were locked and loaded. Here's how David McCullough describes the men of New England. Quote, "The men of the citizen militia with Washington were so accustomed to firearms since childhood. They used them any way they saw fit, almost any time they pleased, to start fires, for example, or blast away at wild geese," end quote. You'll find that quote on page 33 of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, 1776, in the 2005 edition, for you detractors who say I don't cite my sources properly. Now, if you change your mind about maintaining our ancient American prerogatives regarding firearms, that's fine. I hope no harm befalls you. I'm being sincere. But don't get mad at me for doing what my and your own forefathers have done for literally centuries and running back beyond that into the hidden caches of swords held from the Normans by our Anglo-Saxon forefathers and our Scottish forebears who held them from the English and our Hungarian brothers who hid them from the Soviets, and the list could go on, and you know it could. And if you think you are the culmination of human progress and change, well, the proof is in the pudding. How's the service at your local restaurants? Is it better or worse? How's the literacy of your students? Is it better or worse? Are the pockets of civilization growing or receding in the lands that you control? I'm asking you normal people, not the priests who preside over us. By priests, I'm talking about modern-day commissars, such as so-called experts on independent monitoring teams for police and equal opportunity leaders in the military. These are the modern-day thought police, who can and will say anything to keep their easy, well-padded jobs. Their answers are as meaningless as all false priests who are confronted with real truth. We've all seen these puppets dance on video broadcasts and meetings from sea to shining sea. We know things are good for the managers. They get the best of everything. You should see their parties, no expense spared, open bar. I know, I've been to them, and academia is the worst of all. It always reminds me of Proverbs 3:10. Their barns are filled with plenty, and their vats shall burst out with new wine. But how are things for you, normal teacher, normal cop, normal everyday soldier? Are they better or are they worse? Is your pension better or worse? Is your daughter more or less safe on public transport? We all know the answer. And if you don't believe me, just ask Irina Zarutska. Anyway, after April 30th, leaving Boston became progressively more difficult for a number of reasons. General Gage, the man in charge of the British garrison in Boston, was worried that if he allowed American sympathizers to leave, the colonists would bombard Boston and turn the third largest city in North America into a prequel of Dien Bien Phu. Indeed, if Washington had destroyed Gage and his army with little losses, it would have been a massive victory for a backwoods colonial militia. Second, Gage started making colonists leave their property. And then, after that, he started making Americans leave one family member behind as a hostage. Go ahead and bomb us, Washington. Your family members will be the first to taste shrapnel. Former Nazi soldiers in the Foreign Legion used a similar tactic to Vietnamese insurgents, or I should say on Vietnamese insurgents, during France's Indochina War. In the end, the British authorities decided to stop allowing almost anyone except the poor and the criminal to leave. Consequently, around 7,000 colonial sympathizers were trapped in the city, hostages with a human face, living in what Marcuse might call a polite hell. Relations between the numerous, overwhelmingly male British soldiers and the nationalist Bostonians were incredibly strained, often breaking out into open, small-scale violence. The thousands of Americans surrounding the city were no help at all. They often sniped at any man wearing a British uniform, and as a consequence, Gage and his successor imposed a martial law system that maintained peace. But I want to point out, dealing with thousands of sympathizers in Boston distracted the British command from dealing with the external threat of George Washington and the eagle-faced Americans' ballooning forces surrounding Boston Harbor. One thing I will say for Gage is he sure knew how to deal with looters. If enlisted British soldiers even entered private homes, General Gage would have them brutally flogged or even executed. Harassing an American woman was taking your life into your own hands. In the meantime, conditions inside Boston were bad and getting worse. Horses had little food, humans had a little more, most of which was salted meat, and no vegetables. There was very little bread in the city as well. Loyalists, British and Americans, suffered the consequences. One Loyalist minister wrote at the time, "In Boston, it's not uncommon to bury 20 to 30 people a week, both troops and civilians." Now, if you remember from last month's episode, there were about 17,000 Americans encamped around Boston Harbor. American newspapers called Washington's army the Grand American Army. The colonials, peering down on Boston, were short of everything: cloth to make tents, food, ammunition, firearms, and cannon. But luckily for the Americans, in the middle of May, the news of the fall of Ticonderoga, which was a fort, came to the American lines. The British fort on the southern end of Lake Champlain, in the middle of New York, had fallen to 85 New England frontiersmen. They called themselves the Green Mountain Boys, and they had captured Fort Ticonderoga with a daring raid. The New England men simply rowed a large rowboat to the shores of the fort, hopped out, and overwhelmed the half-awake redcoats, who surrendered to them without even fighting. The 85 pioneers couldn't believe what they found inside the fort. There were 200 top-of-the-line cannon, literally tons of musket balls, more than 30,000 flints, which were essential for contemporary firearms, and to top it all off, probably the most important single item, by the way, was 49 gallons of Caribbean rum, much of which was consumed on the spot by the Green Mountain Boys. Hail, all hail, noble forefathers. All of it was needed in Boston, and it was assumed most of it would be taken to Boston, I mean, excluding the rum. But Boston was more than 200 miles away, and dragging 200 iron cannon across the primitive trails and paths of backwoods New England was no small task. Besides which, the Green Mountain Boys were hungover from all that rum they'd been drinking. But General Gage wasn't sitting on his hands this whole time. He also received reinforcements, bringing the total number of troops under his command to over 6,000, though he was still outnumbered by the 17,000 ill-trained Americans surrounding him. But Gage had crack professional troops, not militiamen, worried about getting back to Rochester so they could get the pumpkins planted in time for harvest in October. In July 1775, General Gage, the commander of British forces in Boston, felt his force was strong enough to assault Breed's Hill, which is also known as Bunker Hill, which was located directly north of the city of Boston across a small body of water near a town called Charlestown. Predictably, given the large number of sympathizers in Boston, the Americans found out about Gage's plan and built a redoubt, or temporary fort, on top of Breed's Hill, which is a mound right next to another hill crest called Bunker Hill. So you have two separate hills north of Boston, both of which command Boston Harbor and the nearby port. The hill physically closest to Boston is Breed's Hill, and behind it, over which American forces will have to fall back if they lose the coming battle, is Bunker Hill. And that's where the name, the Battle of Bunker Hill, comes from. Below both hills was a town called Charlestown. Now, I told you before, there were 17,000 Americans surrounding Boston, but they were spread out over 10 miles. However, at Breed's Hill, there were just a few thousand dug-in American militiamen. Still a formidable force, though. And the Americans had worked like beavers under the command of Colonel William Prescott, constructing a hive of defensive works which reached in long musket-prickling branches all the way down to the Mystic River. Here's how Rick Atkinson describes William Prescott, quote, "The colonel was from Pepperell, Massachusetts. He was 49 and bookish. He had fought twice in Canada during wars against the French, earning a reputation for cool self-possession under fire. In this war, he vowed never to be taken alive. One soldier remembered him with these words, 'Prescott was a bold man, and he gave orders like a boss.'" End quote. From the moment Prescott's men arrived at Breed's Hill, they started building entrenchments by hand. The sound of their nocturnal work alerted the patrolling British vessels, which started shelling the Americans as they grunted with hand tools, sweating buckets of water to keep from bleeding gallons of blood. Rick Atkinson describes the bombardment from the ocean-going ships of the British, quote, "The British ships beat to quarters. Sailors tumbled from their swinging hammocks, feet clapping across the deck as they ran to their battle stations. A shouted command carried across the gun deck, and tongues of flame burst from the ships in broadsides of nine-pounders. Breaching ropes kept the guns from flying across the deck in their prodigious recoil. Block and tackle ran them forward for the next salvo. Gunners swabbed the smoking barrels, rammed home powder and shot, and another flock of iron balls flew towards Breed's Hill. More than 70 guns all told from five ships, along with the British 24-pounders in Boston itself, rained down death on the scrambling Americans, desperately trying to worm underground like fretful moles. At dawn, the laboring Americans were visible to the British gunners. Screaming cannonballs called tea kettlers punched into the hillside around the grim-faced workers. "We thought we would all be slain," one American named Peter Brown would later write. One militiaman caught a round right in the face, and his whole head simply disappeared in a flash. One second, Colonel Prescott was talking to the man. The next second, his head was a whirling cloud of mincemeat and blood. Prescott later recalled, "The man was so near to me that my own clothes were besmeared with his blood and greasy brains, which I wiped off with handfuls of clumping earth." And when other men dropped their tools to gawk at the corpse, Prescott laconically snapped, "Bury him," then strolled off with conspicuous nonchalance, even though his own hat had been blown off and he was bathed in human gore. The redoubt, taking shape under Prescott's watchful hand, was strong, with thick dirt walls 6 feet high, fire steps for musket men to stand on, and a sally port exit to the north. But there were no places for cannon, and Prescott realized the British could outflank him on either side. To protect his left flank, Prescott ordered the men to begin building a low breastwork northeast from the sally port, end quote. On the early afternoon of June 17th, General Gage sent 2,000 troops to Charlestown in preparation for an assault on nearby Breed's Hill. The British were literally gleaming. Many of them had recently been issued brand new firearms, and they were loaded down with provisions, 60 rounds of ammunition, enough food for an entire day, the works. The men made their way onto the rough, splintered docks of Boston Harbor, where they tripped over themselves loading into 28 small boats of various makes. The makeshift mini armada of rowboats made their way in two lines across the harbor to Charlestown, each boat following the one in front with the regularity of baby geese, haphazardly swimming behind their mother. Further away, the larger naval ships resumed pounding the American positions with their heavy cannon. It sounded like an American fireworks display. You could actually feel the echo of the guns, the sound waves shaking the rowboats the way the water trembled in the film Jurassic Park. Thousands of spectators gathered along the streets and windows of Boston to watch the awesome display of raw English power. The whole time, hundreds of Americans worked like maniacs under Prescott's orders, strengthening the redoubt and expanding their fortifications along an old wooden fence and stone wall. The colonials manhandled new logs into the fence rows and chinked the remaining space with soil and hay, forming a makeshift breastwork for the laboring Massachusetts men. They even brought forward some small field guns. Hundreds of New Hampshire men arrived and built their own low wall out of rocks. And when the British arrived, they would be facing entrenched opposition. The British were led by General William Howe, a man of almost suicidal courage and a veteran of the French and Indian War. Howe had an ingenious plan for taking the heights. Frontal assault, an old favorite on this show. Howe should have known better than to attack into the teeth of American fortifications, but many scholars believe he was blinded by his own arrogance and thought the Americans would retreat when they met real opposition. To put it mildly, Howe was wrong. One day, one of you listeners may be in charge of a military command somewhere, or even a gang. I don't know where you are. It doesn't matter where. Listen to me. Do not attempt a frontal assault. You ain't Napoleon charging the bridge at Arcole. That's the 5% anomaly they always talk about in statistics. Don't do it. Go the long way. Work around the perimeter. Frontal assaults are almost always a sad waste of human life. And if you don't believe me, just ask the current legislature of the Confederate States of America, which don't exist in large measure because of Pickett's fruitless frontal assault at Gettysburg. Meanwhile, the British landed unopposed at Morton's Point below Breed's Hill. Anyone can see the New England defenders were in a strong position. General Howe squinted as he stepped atop a nearby hill and examined the colonial redoubt towering above him like a second Baradur. It wasn't looking good. Rick Atkinson takes up the story, quote, "On Howe's far left, American gunmen infested rooftops and barns in Charlestown, while up the grassy slope of Breed's Hill, 500 yards from where Howe was standing, a large bastion had sprouted from the hillside. The rest of the American defenses came into view. The triangular fortifications, several guns throwing an occasional ball inaccurately towards the British lines, and the long fence, or was it a wall, bristling with men stripped to their shift sleeves and still working to fortify their position. The fields and pastures ended in a short plunge to the Mystic River shoreline. Hal could make out even more rebels working mischief atop Bunker Hill behind the main American battle lines. Hal made his plan. The Mystic Beach seemed a promising corridor from which to outflank and turn the New England line. On foot, the general would personally lead the British right flank and assault the rail fence while a column of light infantry companies slashed up the river shoreline. The left wing would attack the redoubt to fix the enemy in place and maybe even overrun the parapet. Once Howe's troops scythed through the American flank, slicing into it with the adept skill of a veteran buffet worker, cutting a bleeding chunk of roast beef, end quote. The attack began at 3 o'clock with, predictably, an artillery barrage. At the same time, the British regulars shouldered their 5-foot-long Brown Bess muskets and formed into two main battle groupings, lining up like 10 soldiers as they did so. On the left of the battle line, 10 British companies formed ranks shoulder to shoulder in a broad fan. Behind these, another 10 companies formed up. On the right flank, a mirror image appeared. 10 companies next to one another, with another line of 10 companies in support. It was war by geometry. The companies actually looked like something out of the Total War video game series. Then the cry from the junior officers rang out, "Push on!" And with that, thousands of redcoats made their way up Breed's Hill, the left battle line straight into the American lines with a suicidal frontal assault, the right line attempting to flank the main American positions along the banks of the Mystic River. And keep in mind, Breed's Hill is on a peninsula with an extremely narrow land connection to the mainland. Consequently, it's not like the right flank of the British line has a lot of space to maneuver around in. Literally, the rightmost company on the British attack formation was marching right next to the wonderfully named Mystic River. Now, to give you an idea of the battle geography, I want you to imagine an isosceles triangle. Of course, I know all of you remember from math class where you diligently listen with passionate attention as your droning geometry teacher perfunctorily explained the properties of triangles to you. But for those of you who don't remember, an isosceles triangle is a triangle with two sides of equal length and consequently two angles of equal measure. It looks a lot like a two-dimensional pyramid. Now tip our pyramid on the left-hand side, so it looks like a greater than symbol for inequality in algebra. Now at the pinnacle of the pyramid is a narrow land connection. In the middle of the triangle are two hills, the largest of which is called Breed's Hill. Behind Breed's Hill, towards the pinnacle of our side place triangle, is Bunker's Hill. On Breed's Hill is the main fortification. Now the British landed at the bottom, the base of the triangle, on the right hand side, and they're going to make their way up the middle and the right of the isosceles triangle. On either side of the triangle is water, hence the lack of maneuver. The Americans were funneling the British like a second Leonidas. But there's one thing that can be said for General Howe leading his troops of the Empire. He was brave, leading from the front line of the right British flank. As the redcoats made their way to the redoubt, one American remembered the sight of the oncoming veteran English and Irishman, and he said it was an awful moment. The colonials gave worried glances to the men next to them, checking and rechecking their firearms as the white-haired American General Israel Putnam, a leading officer in the American line, slapped the frightened colonials with the dull side of his saber and gingerly threatened to cut down anyone who retreated with the careless nonchalance of a checkout clerk asking if a patron wants paper or plastic grocery bags. At the same time, cannonballs, which had been deliberately heated in brick fireplaces located on the circuitous traversing British ships, began to fall on Charlestown. The English were deliberately trying to set the buildings of the town on fire. It didn't take long, and the glowing balls went to work, turning Charlestown into a conflagration of heat, smoke, and death. Atkinson masterfully details what happened next, quote, "Within minutes of the bombardment, the whole town was instantly in flames. Fire loped through Charlestown's streets like a thing alive, igniting buildings at the foot of Chestnut Street and around the shipyard. Other structures along the docks followed in quick, flaming succession. Distilleries, their storage warehouses exploding like bombs, a tannery, warehouses, shipwrights, a barrel-making factory all exploding and flaming like something out of Yukio Mishima's fevered imagination. Fire climbed the high-pitched roofs, a grand and melancholy sight, one observer later remembered, then licked through houses away from the waterfront and up to the marketplace, incinerating the courthouse and the Three Cranes Tavern. That's sad right there. North of the market, more houses and yet another distillery caught fire in an eardrum-bursting cacophony of explosions. The light breeze shifted, and flames drove lengthwise through the town. Fire, like a man violent with hunger, eight more wharves and shipbuilding factories. Ebony smoke rose in a column as wide as the town itself, then hung like a thundercloud over the contending armies, as one American officer reported. Rebel musketmen scurried from the burning buildings like harried field mice, when imperious eagles, talons splayed with slicing death, swooped down on them. The church steeples were great pyramids of fire above the rest of the burning town, wrote one officer. The roar of cannon, mortars, musketry, and the crash of churches, ships upon the stocks, the whole streets falling together in ruin, filled the ears and was one of the greatest scenes of war that you can ever conceive of, end quote. Charlestown citizens looked down from the safety of the mainland shore and saw everything they owned burning in riotous flames. Hundreds of people cried or comforted one another as their livelihood turned to smoke and ash, a sacrifice for the people of Massachusetts that should never be forgotten. But how many of you, sons of Boston, remember all these sacrifices? What did they lose everything for? How about you, men of Lewiston, Maine, you big Maine men? Look around your streets and tell me this is what your pilgrim forefathers froze and struggled to build to make Maine safe for effeminate social media influencers and dwindling Maine families? When was the last time you heard anyone who gave a shit about Maine? Well, I give a shit about Maine. At 4 p.m., the British attacked in two Maine groups, just like Howe had planned. One body went straight up Breed's Hill, the second down the rightmost point of the peninsula. The whole time, the smell of burning buildings scented the air. You could feel the heat from the combusting cityscape. Picture in your mind a roaring fire engulfing a pyramid of dry wood. Remember the last time you saw a conic bonfire crumble, the glowing logs falling, spring fireflies of luminescent embers and wild arcs across the night sky. Now magnify that image a thousandfold as the factories and townhomes of Charlestown tumbled over in blazing ruin, sending cannonball-sized embers ejaculating into the sky. The onlooking Americans, enraged by the combusting scene, loaded their muskets with buck and ball, a lead bullet coupled with two or three buckshot. Think of it as a round bullet fired with a small shotgun round at the same time. They had murder on their minds. The American officers deliberately told their militiamen to fire at British officers first. Meanwhile, the British right flank was struggling through mud and grassland, along with a seemingly inexhaustible number of fence rows, which constantly forced the British to stop, dismantle the fence, and then proceed again over and over. In the forward ranks, British light infantry standing five abreast formed a compact column as they snaked their way along the riverbank, screened from the main American position by the tall walls of the Mystic River Bank. 300 men were slipping and sliding their way towards the American lines, literally at the rightmost part of the peninsula. That's when the American reinforced fence line came into view. The 23rd Royal Welsh Fusiliers got to within 50 yards and then charged the few dozen Americans behind the makeshift breastwork. A volley sent a hammer blow of shot and ball into the front of the redcoat line. Men caught musket balls and crumpled into heaps of writhing, screaming balls of terror-faced victims. One Welshman caught a bullet in his chest, and it exploded out his back with the force of a popping cyst, exploding brackish detritus everywhere. On the British line came, carefully stepping over their fallen comrades before they themselves were shot down by the entrenched Americans. In a few minutes, one-third of the Welshmen In the 23rd, we're wounded. The beach littered with their squirming, terror-screaming bodies. Reinforcements pushed on past the wounded men as Hal fed more meat into the sausage grinder. One commentator said it was like pushing a wax candle against a red-hot plate. The head of the Welsh column simply melted away. Many British were wounded multiple times. The men who weren't hit were literally covered in the bodily tissues and bone fragments of their own comrades because there was such a narrow line of attack between the riverbank and the ocean. Just imagine a beach covered with moaning, screaming, dying men. That's what the beach of Charlestown looked like. The regulars couldn't keep up the pressure. There were few who could. Even the Spartans or samurai might have retreated in the face of such heavy American resistance. In the end, the redcoats fell back, leaving 90 men behind, the ground covered with dead like a field of cattle put down to stop the spread of a plague. Meanwhile, above the riverbank, General Howe and his redcoats were pressing into the American breastworks and catching hell the whole way. One second a man would be marching forward, the next second he would be stepping into the next life, making his way into the great, wide, undiscovered country. An American militiaman remembers the scene with these words, quote, "The whole line was one blaze of fury. The redcoats fell in heaps. Actually, in heaps, I mean that literally, like sacks of nuts just picked from the harvest. The bodies were thick, and they carpeted the grass in thrashing death." End quote. As the front line melted away under the American bombardment, English regulars from the second line, with practiced swiftness, stepped into the vacancy left by their dying compatriots, only to get mowed down themselves. Then volleys of musketry from Howe's left flank began to sweep his entire battle line. The Americans were attacking from strong points on his left. Instead of Howe flanking the Colonials, the entrenched New Englanders were actually flanking his line. The fire was so thick, tree branches actually were cut in two by the musketry and shot. How's that for trimming the rose bushes? Howe had no choice but to temporarily fall back and regroup, but he had no intention of retreating. After a few moments' pause, the British would restart the suicidal attacks, flinging their bodies at the American lines as if they were broken-hearted men who welcomed death. Now the action shifted to the middle of the peninsula, as the left of the British line, coming in two fan-like formations, made its way straight at the redoubt dug into Breed's Hill. The whole way, the British were hampered by fences, stone walls, and smoke. As they neared the American strong point, they were forced to stop by an enclosure, and that's when the Americans, their aim honed from lifetimes of hunting, shot down the British like whimpering dogs in an enclosed pen. One colonial actually remembered it was more difficult to shoot a deer than a British man because the deer broke and fled, but the British stayed in formation, murdered by their own discipline. An American militiaman later recalled, "We cut them down like grass when mowed." For about 50 minutes, the redcoats tried to work the Americans out of the redoubt, as their numbers steadily thinned, but the redcoats did not retreat. Some men built breastworks from the bodies of their fallen comrades, a red-coated wall of corpse, which made a sickening, wet, thudding sound as the whistling balls caught their unfeeling bodies. One eyewitness remembered the scene. The redcoats advanced on us in order to swallow us, but they found we stuck in their throats. If the British were going to break through, something would have to change. That's when General Howe made the change, the way an HVAC repairman suddenly identifies and fixes a problem. Using 500 reinforcements just landing behind his battle lines, Howe told his men to advance in column formation rather than spread out fan-like, which substantially diminished the effectiveness of American firepower. In addition, eight British cannon were dragged by hand lines into the thick of the fighting, directly towards the middle of the American strong point. The gunners packed the cannon with grape shot, plum-sized balls of lead loaded into sacks that burst into multiple flying projectiles when fired. Think of them as giant shotgun shells. Against this massive force arrayed against him, Colonel Prescott had just 150 soot-faced men waiting to fend off the British blow. The men, so covered in ash and dirt that they resembled minstrel characters. Worse still, the Americans were running low on ammunition, and all six American cannons were out of action. Resupplies and reinforcements were desperately needed, and hardly any were coming through. Leaderless militiamen were wandering around behind the front lines, totally ineffective, a walking testament to the old aristocratic argument that democracy invariably leads to disorganization. You could actually imagine Joseph de Maistre and Juan Donoso Cortez nodding to themselves at the disorganization of the American forces. And the whole time, British gunners from the ships in the ocean continued to rain meteoric death down on the New England colonials. The sun was going down when the British resumed their advance. The British cannon exploded in a riot of grape shot, which sent Americans backflip spiraling like Olympic gymnasts. The earthen redoubt itself started crumbling from the withering fire. Still, the Americans brought down a dozen of the men methodically working the field pieces a few dozen yards away. I'm talking about the British cannoneers. One American officer felt bad shooting such good-looking men, men who just a few weeks ago might have been his own countrymen. But the colonists felt they had to do it. The main British line pushed forward when Colonel Prescott gave the order to attack, and the Americans hopped to their firing steps with the alacrity of male rabbits jumping towards females in heat. The colonials fired and staggered the onrushing British line, but still the redcoats pressed forward, their gaps in their line filled by the men mirroring their march from behind. One grenadier officer had the top of his skull shaved off by a musket ball. As he rolled on the ground, he pathetically begged his comrades to let him die in peace, and the men stepped around him and left the writhing officer to bleed out. An historian describes the last assault of the battle like this, quote, "The battle had turned. Redcoat regulars pressed close in on the Americans from three sides, leaping across a narrow ditch to hug the American earthen walls before scrambling over the steep ramparts. American gunshots grew scattered. Our firing began to slack until at last it petered out like an old candle." Beat'em, Maynard later recalled. More redcoats tumbled into the militia redoubt, shooting down anyone nearby. "Take the guns away!" Colonel Prescott yelled. "Snatch them away!" Enemies grappled hand to sweat slippery hand, grunting and swearing. A brown miasma of smoke and churning dust hung in the air. Americans swung their muskets as clubs, fighting more like demons than man. And when the wooden stocks of their muskets shattered, the defenders swung the bent barrels of their guns or large rocks. Prescott was among the last to escape, parrying bayonet thrusts with his sword like a master samurai, somehow keeping the blades from connecting with his flesh. American Peter Brown scrambled over the wall and ran for half a mile, musket balls flying like hail all around him. Captain Bancroft fought his way out, first with a musket butt, then with his fist, bullets nicking his hat and coat and shearing off the tip of his left forefinger, the top of which periodically stream-leaked blood, the way a broken water fountain sends a steady but weak stream out of its nozzle. The British had given him something to remember them by. Corporal Farnsworth later wrote, "I received a wound in my right arm, the ball going through a little below my elbow. Another ball struck my back, taking a chunk of skin about as big as a penny. I was in great pain, I can assure you." These were the lucky ones, one officer remembered. "Nothing could be more shocking than the carnage that followed the storming of this work. We tumbled over the dead to get at the living, who were crowding out of the gorge in the redoubt. The fortification was streaming with blood and strewed with dead and dying men, the soldiers stabbing some and dashing out the brains of others. 30 American bodies, some mutilated beyond recognition, lay scattered across the ruined redoubt." The Connecticut militia arrived to see the melee spill from the sally port. One man wrote, "I had no other feeling but that of revenge. Four men were shot dead within 5 feet of me. I escaped with only the graze of a musket ball on my hat. Another man had the back of his head blown out. He died instantaneously, his corpse flopping to the ground like a wet towel, carelessly thrown aside by a carefree child." By 5:30 p.m., American forces were in full retreat across the narrow land bridge and out of the Charlestown Peninsula, leaving behind a traceable trail of discarded equipment. Americans by the hundreds surged through the gauntlet of naval gunfire, still scything the only exit from the peninsula. Some died within yards of safety, including Major Andrew McCleary, who was bodily struck with a frigate cannonball. The ball threw the major 3 feet in the air, and then his flopping body pitched forward. He was dead when he landed. Meanwhile, on the night-darkened battlefield, British medical staff felt for the wounded in the high grass. All across the peninsula, the moans and crying of the wounded were heard, a scene from Dante's Inferno audibly bursting forth into the real world, end quote. The strong defense of the Americans led to a British tactical victory, but an American strategic triumph. Because the British had suffered so many casualties, they failed to follow up their victory on Breed's Hill by routing the over 10,000 Americans still entrenched around Boston. At the end of the battle, The British had taken Charlestown and occupied it. Their position in Boston was much more secure as a consequence, but they were still in Boston, bottled up like a Coca-Cola, and they weren't going anywhere. Daniel Marston provides this succinct summary of the battle's outcome, so I'll just quote him, quote, "The British had seized Breed's Hill, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. Of the 2,500 British troops involved, 228 had been killed and a further 800 wounded, losses that the British could not easily replace. But there were millions of Americans on the other side of Bunker Hill, Americans who had firearms and knew how to use them. The Americans, on the other hand, had lost only 100 killed and 270 wounded. These casualties were the worst the British suffered during the war, as Gage noted in a letter that was published in the London Gazette. The trials we have show that the rebels are not the despicable rabble too many have thought them to be. The Battle of Bunker Hill also made it clear to the Americans that, though they may be successful in defense, they needed a professional, continental-style army to challenge the British in the open fields of America. After the casualties suffered at Breed's Hill, the British decided not to attack Dorchester Heights, leaving the Americans dug in like cleaving barnacles. As a consequence, the British remained holed up in Boston for the rest of the year, and General Gage was replaced by General William Howe as Commander-in-Chief of America in October 1775. It wouldn't be long, and Howe would strike back. But we'll hear that story in another podcast. And that's another one in the books for me. Join us next month when I recount the terrible history of the Skeleton March through the absolute and total wilderness of western Maine. Thousands of men entered that hardwood desert, and only hundreds emerged on the other side to besiege Quebec. If a few more hundred men had made it, Canada might well be an American state right now. But that's how close the strategic situation was, and you won't want to miss the episode. But until that time, I'm Dr. Luke Wolf. And I'm wishing you good times and good weather with good people. Pop one with me. Bye.